Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're having a fun Friday here, more fun than we should probably be allowed to have. Jimmy Akins here, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. It's open forum, and we're just doing whatever we want. Well, I don't know. We're not doing whatever we want, but we're having a good time. Jimmy, thanks for remaining for the second hour.
We're wanting what we do.
We're wanting what we do.
Yeah, so we're having fun with it.
That sounds almost Yoda-like. Zach, the
video. One of those mysterious things in our world.
What, Yoda?
Yeah, well, or wanting what you do.
Yeah.
And how that all works.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to tell Zach, you know, the video guy.
Yeah.
He just left.
Oh.
So I wanted to tell his mom and dad he's on the way home.
Okay.
So.
Good. Yeah. At end of last hour, you were like implying I was going to flee the scene, and you were the one who got up and left the studio. I've been sitting here the whole time as the video record on Facebook and YouTube will show.
Man, you are litigious today, Jimmy Akin. I don't believe we're going to be calling witnesses in.
it's interesting. There has been a kind of interesting historical connection between legal thinking and apologetics and so forth. So and theology.
Really?
So yeah. So like one of the early Christian apologists, a guy named Tertullian, who lived around the year 200. He was actually a lawyer.
Okay.
Before he became a Christian and then used his thinking skills in service of the faith. Unfortunately, he also went a little bit off the rails, but eventually. But, you know, he had a legal mind. A lot of other people have, like John Calvin, famous Protestant reformer, had a legal background. Lots of people have had legal backgrounds. And actually, I started to go to law school some years ago. Before I was an apologist, you know, I was in college and I was a philosophy major. And so that's, you know, thinking skill related. But then, there was a period where I investigated going to law school and I got as far as taking the LSAT, which is the legal skills aptitude test.
Yeah.
And scored really well on that, but ended up deciding not to pursue that. But, I read books about law and I've realized that functioning as an apologist, I tend to think alternatingly like a prosecutor and a defense attorney because I'll test an idea, I'll make the best case for it I can, and then I'll try to tear it down. And I'm constantly switching back and forth mentally between the functions of a prosecuting attorney and a defense attorney.
Yeah. That, you know what I was thinking of as you said that?
Mm-hmm.
Carl Keating.
Yeah, yeah. Also, Carl was a lawyer before he became an apologist.
Yeah. I don't remember. Oh, because I said you were litigious. That's how we got onto that.
You got us onto that.
Yeah. Blaming me. Well, I'm glad you are here for this second hour, Jimmy, and everybody else is here, like Nick's over there and Brandon and Marie and Darren, because it's open forum and we're going to need all the brains we can get. All the hard questions come on open forum. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884 if you've got one, if you want to know something about the Catholic faith. Whether you know a lot about the Catholic faith and you want something cleared up, or you know nothing about the Catholic faith and you'd like to get some information on this or that point, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. Nick in
Minneapolis.
Supposed to pretend like
Millennialapolis, the city of a thousand years.
So much better to pretend that those things didn't happen. You see why I gave up the attempt to be perfect, though.
Well, you're just trying to make everyone else look good.
Yeah,
just very charitable.
I want people to be comfortable around me.
Yeah.
I don't want anyone
I'm very comfortable around you, Simon.
Thank you.
You're a comfy guy.
Yeah, thanks. Nick in Minneapolis, Minnesota, watching on YouTube Live. You are up first this hour. Your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, actually, I just recently discovered the channel, too, and I have to say I'm very, very impressed. So you guys are doing a great job.
Oh, thank you.
I come from an Orthodox background, so I wish we had something like this.
Which kind of Orthodox do you come from?
It'd be Eastern or Greek. We go to a Greek Orthodox.
Greek Orthodox Church. Okay.
Yep. And we're actually former Protestants, so kind of reformed our ways from that, you could say. So. But yesterday, I was on hold for a while, and I had to run. But I remember specifically Jimmy stating that he had just recently completed a commentaries on 1st and 2nd Thessalonians.
Right, yeah.
And there's always a passage in 2nd Thessalonians where St. Paul talks about the man of lawlessness and mm-hmm. how this lawlessness is at work, and that his audience that Paul, St. Paul's writing to, seems to have awareness of who this individual is or what it is. Mm-hmm. But then he also transitions into this restrainer. And my question to Jimmy is, I'd like to get your perspective, because I'm sure this is a very debated, many interpretations within the different aspects of Christianity on who or what that is, mm-hmm. what your interpretation is. So I'd really like to get that from you.
Sure. So you're right, and I do indeed go into this in quite a lot of detail in my commentary. In fact, the chapter on 2 Thessalonians 2, which is where this passage is the longest chapter in the whole book. It's like over 10,000 words because there's a lot to talk about here. Unfortunately, I won't have time to give you 10,000 words on the subject at the moment because it takes about an hour to speak 10,000 words, but I can give you a little short segment on it. Basically, so what St. Paul is doing at this point in 2 Thessalonians is he's trying to correct an idea that the Thessalonians have gotten probably based on something they misunderstood in 1 Thessalonians, at least in part based on that. Some of them are thinking that the day of the Lord, meaning the end of the world, may have already arrived. Either it's happened and we missed it, or it started, but and Jesus is about to return any second, or something. It's like we're way closer to the end of the world than what Paul is prepared to say. And so in 2 Thessalonians, he says, don't let anybody confuse you about this, because as I told you before when I was in Thessalonica, there are a series of things that have to happen before the day of the Lord and our gathering together to be with him. And he names initially two things that have to occur first. One, he calls the rebellion. In some translations, it says apostasy, but that word has a technical meaning in English that Paul probably didn't mean. So he says the rebellion has to occur and the revelation of the man of lawlessness. Some manuscripts say man of sin, but man of lawlessness is probably the original reading. And the man of lawlessness seems to be the leader of the rebellion, you know, because rebellions rebel against laws. And so the man of lawlessness seems to be the chief rebel. And he then says that the mystery of lawlessness, meaning the hidden forces of lawlessness that the devil inspires, those are already at work. But something is restraining them. And he tells the Thessalonians, you know what it is, because he had informed them of it previously. You know what the restrainer is. And he refers to the restrainer two ways. The first time he does it, he uses the neuter gender. And the second time he uses it, he refers to the restrainer, he uses the masculine gender in Greek. And so whatever the restrainer is, it can be conceptualized in more than one way. One of them you would use a neuter noun for. Another you would use a masculine noun for. And that could mean the restrainer takes the form of a person, but not a man.
Yeah.
But not necessarily, because other Greek nouns are masculine even though they don't mean people. For example, the Greek noun nomos means law, but it's also masculine. And so if he's thinking law restrains the forces of lawlessness, he would use a masculine noun without thinking of a particular person. So the restrainer is very mysterious. We get a little more, though, about the man of lawlessness, because he says that the man of lawlessness will be revealed, and then at the second coming, Jesus will slay him with the breath of his mouth. And so that tells us that the ultimate fulfillment of the man of lawlessness is as an eschatological figure that who will be alive at the end of the world. Oh, he also says the man of lawlessness exalts himself above every god, mm-hmm. including the true God, and every object of worship, meaning every idol,
mm-hmm.
And that he takes his seat in the temple of God, portraying himself as God. Now, in a first century context, that temple reference would almost certainly be taken as a reference to the Jerusalem temple.
Mm-hmm.
But the Jerusalem temple was destroyed in AD 70. And so some people have consequently proposed that in order for the man of lawlessness to fulfill this prophecy, the temple is going to have to be rebuilt in Jerusalem. There are other possible meanings of it, though. It's not clear, for example, that Paul meant the temple reference literally.
Mm-hmm.
He's just said the man of lawlessness exalts himself against every god or object of worship. And in that context, saying he takes his seat in the temple of God could just mean he supplants the role of God,
right,
not literally goes to the temple and sits in a chair, which they actually didn't have in the Holy of Holies. They didn't have a chair for anyone to sit down in.
Right.
So it's possible that Paul's being metaphorical at that point. But it's certainly suggestive of things that were happening in the first century, because at this time, now I've already said the ultimate fulfillment of the man of lawlessness has to be a figure who's alive at the time of the second coming. But one of the things you find when you study biblical prophecy is there are these early partial fulfillments of prophecies that later get fulfilled in a greater way. And that seems to be the case here. Because in the first century, you did have people who were exalting themselves above every other god and object of worship, like the Roman emperors, who were some of whom were deified after their death, some of whom were worshipped during their life. And so 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, they're written about the year AD 50. Well, just 10 years before that, the emperor Caligula had demanded worship as a god. He portrayed himself as the new Zeus.
Mm.
Okay, Zeus being the king of the gods.
Right.
So he's saying, like, I'm the new Zeus.
Yeah.
I'm the new king of the gods. Well, he's exalting himself, therefore, above every other god and object of worship by claiming to be the new Zeus. And he ordered, and this didn't end up happening, thank God, but he ordered that a statue of him be put in the temple in Jerusalem, and that the Jerusalem temple be rededicated to him as Gaius, that was his birth name, Gaius, the new Zeus made manifest.
That would not have gone over well.
It would not have gone over well, and it did not. Now, fortunately, he got assassinated in AD 41, and so this didn't end up happening. But for people living in AD 50, this would be like a frightening almost fulfillment.
Yeah.
Of this prophecy.
Right.
And so even though we know, because of other things Paul says, that the man of lawlessness has to be a future figure from our perspective, he is likely going to be an echo or some kind of recapitulation of what these earlier Roman emperors like Caligula were mm-hmm. doing. And in fact, that may have been one of the things that St. Paul and his readers were speculating on. Because in their own context, it would make a lot of sense if they think, as many of them did, the day of the Lord is just about to happen. And even Paul initially thought it was likely to occur in his own lifetime. Well, who are the obvious candidates for being the man of lawlessness? It's the Roman emperors.
Yeah.
And that's probably why he is so circumspect in what he says about the restrainer. Because if he's saying, okay, something is holding back the forces of lawlessness so that the man of sin is not revealed, it could be something connected with the empire. And he had just been kicked out of Thessalonica and accused of treason against Caesar while he was there. So he's not going to get too explicit here in these letters that could fall into pagan hands and then stir up persecution against the Thessalonians. So he and the Thessalonians may well have been speculating that the man of lawlessness would actually be one of the Roman emperors in their own lifetime, like, for example, maybe Nero, who had just been adopted by the Emperor Claudius as a boy. So interesting thoughts, but the ultimate man of sin or man of lawlessness is still in our future.
Okay, Nick?
Yeah, no, can I follow up with just one quick thing? So you would eliminate the Roman Empire as being a possible restrainer.
No, I wouldn't. Ultimately, it has to be something that's still restraining the forces of lawlessness, because in our age, the man of sin has not been revealed. So it would have to be something more general than just the Roman Empire, like the forces of government and lawfulness is restraining the forces of lawlessness. But in the first century, what was playing that role and thus would be a partial fulfillment of the restrainer would be the same thing, the empire, the forces of lawfulness and the peace, the Pax Romana that it had imposed on the world, and even potentially the Emperor Claudius himself. May have been a partial fulfillment of the restrainer at the time. And people have even noticed that Claudius's name sounds like the Latin word verb claudo, which can mean I restrain, I encompass, I build a wall around, I hold back, stuff like that.
Claudius. Nick, thank you very, very much for that. Always good to have a good reflection on the end times and
at the beginning of the year,
at the beginning of the year and heading into the weekend. Thanks, Nick. Call again. Real pleasure talking with you. Don't forget Daily Defense, 50% off right now and through the entire month. Jimmy's book, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, is the subtitle. You get it at shop.catholic.com, and you will automatically get that 50% off at checkout.
This is Harry Connick Jr., and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
How is it possible that God created everyone?
Why do I need to confess my sins to
a
priest?
Why is the Catholic Church so unwilling to wreck?
The Catholic Church is too rich.
Catholics worship Mary and are
committed. As far as I'm concerned, all religions are equal.
You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders. Tonight, 11 p.m. Eastern, on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Open Forum, Catholic Answers Live, Jimmy Akin, our guest Friday. We're having a great time. Let's go to Dominic, Long Island, New York, watching on YouTube Live. Dominic, your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. How you doing? My name is Dominic, as you just said. I'm a junior at American University. My dad watches or listens to you guys all the time, and he absolutely loves you.
He must be a very fine man, your father. Congratulations on having such a fine father.
He's a good guy.
Okay, good.
Yeah, he told me to shoot my question at you and see how you guys answer it.
All right.
So my question, and I'll follow it up with a little bit more so that you can better understand what I'm trying to get at here, how do you reconcile the concept of an all-loving God and an eternal hell? How does it, like, not contradict? And for some reason, the idea of free will doesn't satisfy me, because if you were to know everything or if given enough time, people will eventually choose the best alternative, which would be, of course, Catholicism and Jesus. So I was wondering, how do those, you know, concepts reconcile with each other?
I'm sorry, I need to follow up on an aspect of what you just said. You said you don't find the free will defense satisfying in this case because why?
Because for two reasons. One would be if you were to know, like, the truth, then you would make the right decision. So then in that case, like, why would God not reveal the truth to you?
Okay.
And in another case, you could argue that the free will defense isn't good because given enough time, people will eventually choose the best good.
Just randomly? Or figuring it out on their own? Or
I'm not
why
sure
would,
exactly
why,
how
why,
they would, but I would assume that with time.
Okay. Okay, so let's look at both of those. The first one is I think is dealt with. So let's back up and sketch the overall free will defense here for people who are listening. The basic idea is that God creates all of us and gives us free will as well as various other good qualities, and he would not allow any evil to occur in the world unless there was some way he could bring about at least an equal good from that evil that he allows to occur. He doesn't directly cause evil to occur, certainly not moral evil, but he wouldn't allow any evil, whether moral or otherwise, to occur unless he had a way to bring about at least an equal good out of that. And so consequently, the suffering that is experienced by those who choose damnation is counterbalanced by some other good. And there are different ideas about what that good might be. One of the common proposals is that it's free will, the ability to choose and thus the ability to authentically love rather than just being programmed to have certain feelings or make certain choices, that there's something valuable about free will itself, and that's what counterbalances the evils that are produced as a result of the misuse of free will. Another possibility that has also been proposed is that continued existence itself is a good, even if it's in a situation where you're suffering. Just the fact that you exist and it's not like your suffering is infinite. There are good things about existing that you continue to benefit from even when you're suffering. It's like here on Earth, if you're sick, you are still suffering because of your illness. You know, you have a cold. That's not pleasant. But most people would rather choose to exist in spite of the suffering they're undergoing as a result of their cold than to not exist. And similarly, it is proposed by some that even those who are suffering in hell are preferring their condition to continue to exist despite the frustration that their own choices have caused them. They'd rather still exist in that situation than to not exist. And so it's still a net benefit to them that counterbalances the suffering that they do experience as a result of their choices. So in terms of the two particular objections that you made, Dominic, the first one had to do with why doesn't God reveal the truth to everybody and enable them to choose him and thus be saved? And of course, he could do that. And so this is another subcase of the general problem of evil. And the answer is going to be basically, it's going to be in part the same, that God is producing at least an equal good by not doing that, and then we can speculate on what the nature of that good is. It may one proposal that has been made is he doesn't want to overwhelm our free will in this life by making the truth so blindingly obvious that we have no choice. Personally, I'm somewhat skeptical of that approach to responding to this objection.
Okay,
I think there are other, because I think the truth was blindingly obvious to angels as well.
I see.
And yeah. Among other reasons. And some of them still chose to fall. So I don't think that that is necessarily the best answer. What I would say, though, is God discounts based on knowledge. So if you know the truth and you refuse it, then you will be held responsible for that. But if you don't know the truth through no fault of your own, and you don't embrace it, God is not going to hold you accountable to that truth. And so he will make it possible for anybody to be saved, whether they're Catholic or not, as long as they're cooperating with the truth that they have received. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't need to make it obvious to everybody that Catholicism is true and that they need to become Catholic. He could do that. But he doesn't need to do that in order to be fair to people, because if someone doesn't have the full truth through no fault of their own, he'll only hold them accountable for the knowledge that they do have. And so consequently, it's possible for anybody to be saved regardless of the specific amount of knowledge that they have. The second question dealt with people eventually choosing the truth given enough time. And Dominic indicated he wasn't entirely – he didn't have this idea entirely fleshed out, but if I were to flesh it out, I would say something like, okay, so if you let people live long enough, even if it's 1,000 or 3,000 years, eventually they're going to embrace the truth of Catholicism and be saved. And so that's another objection that one could pose here. And to that, I would say it's not guaranteed they're going to do that. And just because you embrace the truth at one time doesn't mean you can't use free will to then fall away from the truth later on. And so it's not a guarantee that given enough time, everybody is going to embrace the truth. Some people could just as well fall away from it.
Dominic, thanks very much. We got to take a break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
We're glad you're with us. Stick around for more Catholic Answers Live.
A generation ago, Christian parents didn't have to worry about how to explain transgenderism to their 9-year-old children or help their teenager deal with mockery at school for believing in traditional marriage. But today, as our culture decays, we have to know how to talk to our children about these issues. In Made This Way, How to Prepare Kids to Face Today's Tough Moral Issues, Layla Miller and Trent Horn give parents the crucial tools and techniques to form children with the understanding they need, appropriate to their age and maturity level, to meet the world's challenges. If we're not teaching our children how to understand tough moral issues, then the world will. Read Made This Way and learn how to give your kids a firm foundation on which to build a life of moral clarity and happiness. Order your copy of Made This Way today by calling 1-888-291-8000 or logging onto the shop at Catholic.com.
With the recent commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the release of Humanae Vitae, there have been fresh attacks on Catholic teaching from outside and, unfortunately, inside the Church. That's why Catholic Answers thought it critical to provide a vigorous affirmation of Pope Paul VI's prophetic wisdom with our newest book, Inseparable, 5 Perspectives on Sex, Life, and Love in Defense of Humanae Vitae. We asked 5 distinguished contributors to reflect on and defend Humanae Vitae from 5 perspectives, each of them compelling, together forming a mosaic of truth. Don't be caught uninformed when the topic comes up among friends, family, and co-workers. Order your copy of Inseparable today by calling 1-888-291-8000 or by visiting the shop at Catholic.com.
Hi, it's Gloria Purvis. Deacon Harold Burke-Sivers joins me and the Morning Glory team starting Monday, January 14th. Morning Glory, it's Catholic Coast to Coast. And now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live. I think we still might be able to get you in if you call now. 888-318-7884 is the number if you've got a question about the Catholic faith. Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, is here to answer those questions.
We're having fun questions today.
It seems like a really good day for – I mean, yeah. You know, we're always happy to take questions, but it just seems like they've been
– some questions are
more
answered
fun than
less than 1,000 times.
Jimmy, where's purgatory in the Bible? No, I'm just kidding. Bill in Buffalo, New York, listening on WLOF, Station of the Cross. You are up. Your question for Jimmy.
Hello. I made up a short riddle here that I think you'll like before my question, and it's this. When is a soda pop can like listening to Catholic Answers again with its awesome host?
I don't know. When is a soda pop can like listening to Catholic Answers Live with its awesome host?
When you recycle it.
Okay.
People do so many things with my name. I've never heard that one. Congratulations, Bill.
Oh, I'm glad you like that.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Well, my question is My question is for the gospel this Sunday, mm-hmm. from the second chapter of Matthew's gospel. It says, when Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of King Herod, Magi from the east arrived in Jerusalem saying, where is the newborn king of the Jews? We saw his star at its rising and have come to do him homage.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to ask and find out, what is this star? Is it an actual kind of conglomeration of events, or what is it?
Well, we don't know for sure. There have been a variety of theories about exactly what the Star of Bethlehem was. One popular theory is that it was a supernatural manifestation of some kind. So it's like God created a new light in the sky to fulfill this role, and that it was just there temporarily. And this is often associated with the idea that the star led the wise men to the baby Jesus. But that's not actually what Matthew says. He doesn't ever say that the star led them or that they followed it. What he says is that they saw the star and they realized that there was a newborn king of the Jews. And so they did the logical thing. They went to see King Herod in his palace and says, where is the newborn king of the Jews? Because Herod's the current king of the Jews. So if he's had a new prince or one of his sons has had a new prince, the palace is the obvious place to go to ask about it. And so they weren't actually following the star. This is something our greeting cards have lied to us about. Then after they're told, go to Bethlehem, they coincidentally see the star in front of them as they approach the house. But that just means it was in that part of the sky. Again, it doesn't mean they were following it. So if they weren't like being led around by this star, then there's less of a need to say that it was some unusual supernatural manifestation, because that's the usual reason that people would propose that it's some supernatural star that doesn't otherwise appear in the skies, because it needs to lead people around and normal stars don't do that. So once you realize they're not actually following it, that puts it in the realm of ordinary natural phenomena, which is what you would expect from the fact they understood its significance. Because if a brand new light appeared in the heavens that nobody had ever seen before and that started then moving around the heavens, how would you look at that and say, oh, there must be a new king of the Jews? You know, that makes no sense.
Yeah.
But if it's something that is part of natural phenomena that you can predict and that is related to other things in the sky, then you could say, okay, it may have some significance. And so here we have proposals that are of ordinary natural phenomena, like the planet Jupiter may have been involved, Jupiter being the king of the planets, the brightest, not the brightest, but it was commonly associated in the ancient world with royalty. The constellation Leo, which was also associated with royalty and with Israel in particular, and the lion of the tribe of Judah, which was to rule Israel. And so so there are other possibilities as well, but it's probably involving stars, including planets, because a planet is a wandering star. The Greek word planetes means wanderer, and so the planets are called that because they're stars in the ancient sense that appear to move their position around in the sky in a way that the other stars, known as the fixed stars, don't. And so these were all considered stars, including the planets, at the time. And so it's probably the Star of Bethlehem was something that would have been a recognized natural phenomenon. It may have been a conjunction involving the planet Jupiter. It may have involved the constellation Leo. It may have involved the constellation Virgo, the Virgin. It is not entirely clear, and there are different speculations on it. The problem in identifying one specific thing is that our records are incomplete, so we don't know about all of the comets and supernovas that could have appeared in this period, although we do have some indication because the Chinese were keeping pretty good records. But also, we don't have a complete knowledge of how all of these phenomena were interpreted by different schools of thought in the ancient Near East. And the most fundamental thing is you have to decide first when was Jesus born to know which range of time should I be looking for phenomena that might indicate the birth of a Jewish prince. And depending on the date you propose, you're going to look at different phenomena in the sky, because there's always something happening in the sky. And so if you say Jesus was born in 1 BC, you're going to look at one set of phenomena. If you say, like I do, he was born in 2 or 3 BC, you're going to look at another set of phenomena. If you say he was born 6 or 7 BC, you're going to look at another set. And so you kind of have to establish when is he born in order to figure out plausible candidates for the Star of Bethlehem. Having mentioned that, I should comment on a documentary that is going to be on the minds of many people in our audience right now called The Star of Bethlehem by Rick Larson. And it is a very interesting documentary. And every time I ever mention The Star of Bethlehem, I get asked about this documentary and what do I think of it.
Okay.
So I'm going to tell you right now, I think it's interesting. I also think there are flaws in the argument, so do not go to the bank on what you see in that documentary.
Bill, thank you very, very much for that question. Rose Marie in Omaha, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Rose Marie, delighted to have you. Your question for Jimmy.
Hi. Well, I heard the earlier program when you had a woman asking, she was having an argument with her friend about whether Jesus was born through the birth canal. Mm-hmm. And so there were a couple of things that I didn't hear when you were giving the explanation, and I wanted to know what you thought of them.
That's unfortunately the nature of live radio. I can't do a core info dump on every subject and stay within the format.
But I wanted, right. And I mm-hmm. just wanted to get your opinion on these two thoughts. These may be thoughts that many have thought of, but they're mm-hmm. just thoughts that I've thought of.
Be happy to help if I can.
Probably.
What are they?
Okay. So the first one is, I mean, I always had that question too when I read Revelation 18. How did, Mary was without sin, so why did she have labor? Because I was assuming that Revelation 18 was referring primarily to Mary. So anyway, the answer that came to my mind, since it says later on that she is the mother of all those who follow Jesus, the King of Kings, it came to my mind that her labor was her labor at the foot of the cross with Jesus going through his suffering mm-hmm. in order to give birth to our spiritual life mm-hmm. in Christ.
It's possible that that's what the meaning is, or at least part of what the meaning is. In fact, we have an earlier prophecy where Joseph and Mary take Jesus to the temple in Luke's gospel. And while they're there, Mary is told that in addition to Jesus being a sign of contradiction that people are going to speak against, a sword will pierce her own heart also. And that presumably is a reference to the sufferings that she will experience as a mother watching what her son goes through, not only on the cross, but also throughout his life and his earthly ministry when people were opposing him in various ways. And that would be naturally painful to any mother. So it's possible to understand the labor pains that the woman in Revelation 12 experiences. It's possible to relate those both to what Mary experienced when Jesus was on the cross and to the sufferings that she experienced throughout Jesus's life, and particularly during his ministry. On the other hand, that's not necessarily what those labor pains are. They could be literal, or they could apply to one of the other things that this symbol points towards, because it also points towards Israel and the church and the first Eve. And we don't want to assume one of those options just because it's convenient for us. There are a variety of options, and we need to think, what would this most plausibly be understood as? What's your second thought?
Lost her.
I guess we lost her. No. But we do have a call screened version of what her second question was, which is, could when Jesus was born, could he have passed through Mary's womb the same way he did pass through the walls of the tomb?
Oh.
And the answer is sure. God obviously was capable of doing that because he did it. Later on, he could have done it here. Now, later, Jesus was in his glorified body and after the resurrection, and therefore it would be more you could argue that it would be more appropriate for this kind of miracle to occur with Jesus when he was in glorified form as opposed to when he was not yet glorified, like when he was still in the womb. So you could say, well, even though God could do it, this wasn't the right time for that. There are, though, early documents, and I alluded to some of them in the first hour, that do talk about Jesus passing through Mary in a miraculous fashion that is similar to what must have happened when he passed through the walls of the tomb. So it is possible that that's the case. It's not a teaching of the church that that's the case. What is a teaching of the church is that Mary was perpetually a virgin. And what that may mean in terms of the process by which Jesus was born is a matter of theological interpretation rather than doctrine.
And again, thank you very, very much, Rosemary, for that question. Sorry we lost contact with you there. Right now, we got to go to a break. But again, I will remind you, it's Pro-Life Month all this month here in America. And Catholic Answers wants to get as many pro-life materials out there as we can. So everything with a pro-life theme here is on sale for $5 a copy. Just go to shop.catholic.com. There's like a banner there. You visit the pro-life category and you get it all. DVDs, CDs, all the other things, including books. Yes, people still read books. It's all on sale, $5 each. Pro-life stuff for pro-life month. Go to shop.catholic.com and get yours.
Join us on air today on Catholic Answers Live.
EWTN, communicating the faith.
Just turned 31. Feel that I'm being called to the priesthood. And I've been attending daily Mass and just finding that falling more in love with Jesus every day and finding more opportunities to, you know, make sacrifices for him myself and just allow him to enter me more. You know, how do we fully surrender to God and to his will so that we can more clearly hear his calling?
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
St. Paul's street evangelization isn't like other evangelism you might have seen on the streets. We don't yell, and we don't force anyone to pay attention to us. Instead, St. Paul's street evangelization is committed to presenting a positive, passionately Catholic presence to a world hungry for truth. For more information, or to start a chapter of your own, go to www.streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com. It's time to do our part.
Catholic Answers Live, open forum, just about to, and is this the first Friday, right?
Yeah.
So tomorrow's first Saturday.
Yeah.
But it's like first Friday of the whole year.
Yeah.
Like, not just the month. I don't know if that gives it any extra oomph, but Joseph in New Jersey, you're next. Joseph's listening on 89.3 FM. Your question for Jimmy, Joseph.
Yes, thank you for all you do. I know there's a prayer out there where it releases 1,000 souls, St. Gertrude. I also, I'm under the impression there's another prayer out there where it's 28,430 souls.
Mm.
I believe it was in the book of the Pieta, but I want to know if the church is, I never hear anybody say anything about it. I'd just like to know if it's true.
Well, the easiest way for me to answer that is by saying that claims of that nature, like this prayer will release X number of souls from purgatory or whatever, those are best put in the category of pious beliefs. They are not church teachings. You will not find documents of the magisterium saying that this is the case. You will not find, especially not of the contemporary magisterium. So you may find prayers that have been authorized for use by church authorities, but the church doesn't sign off on these specific claims about them. And so so it's not church teaching.
Shape the answer.
No problem.
Hey, Joseph, however, if I may say to you, thank you for praying for the dead.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's the obligation of every Christian to pray for the dead, and I do think we Catholics forget about it an awful lot.
Mm-hmm. It's the obligation of every Christian to pray for everybody. Even our enemies.
Right.
Whether they're dead or not.
Wait, you have to pray for your enemies while they're still alive, Jimmy?
Yeah.
That's your claim? I have
that on good authority.
I'm going to need to see. Oh, okay. All right.
I think one of the guests from our previous hour said that. Not me, but a more important guest that you introduced last hour.
Yes, I accidentally introduced you as Jesus. but Jesus did, in fact, say that, yes. Eduardo in Murrieta, California, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Because we're not on the air in Murrieta, California. I don't know if you know that, Jimmy. But a certain
we would love to be.
We sure would.
We would be happy to supply
if there were any radio networks that wanted to put us on.
They can put us on.
That would be a delight. And we'll do the usual good job that we do. We will not let our work flag one bit.
No,
if we go
of course
on.
Not.
Okay, that's enough of that, Eduardo. You probably know what we're talking about. But your question for Jimmy.
Good afternoon to both of you, and I'm really very happy to be able to be part of this Catholic Answers.
Thank you.
And you've been helping me with my walk with the Holy Spirit.
Awesome.
My question is, there are two attributes of God. One is immanent and one is transcendent. Would you kindly explain that? Because I find it that it is opposite to each other.
Yeah, and this is not surprising because God is very different than us. We're finite beings, and God is an infinite being, and so consequently, many things about God are very surprising to us because we're not our minds are too small to grasp the full mystery of God, and so sometimes we run into paradoxical things about God where it's kind of hard to see how they fit together. Famously, that happens like with how does God's justice and mercy fit together? But it can also happen with other things like his attributes of immanence and transcendence. What transcendence means, and I'll obviously need to keep this simple. People have written entire books on this subject. But what his transcendence means is that he is different from and distinct from and distant from all of created reality in a certain sense. In other words, he transcends it. He's more than anything in created reality. He is distinct from everything in created reality. On the other hand, his attribute of immanence emphasizes his closeness to created reality. So even though he's more and greater and in some sense distant and distinct from everything that's created, he also is very close to it, which is what immanence means. For something to be immanent is for it to be close. And so we have statements in the New Testament, for example, saying that in God, in him, we live and move and have our being. And so God is very close to us if we're in him and we live in him and move in him and have our being in him. Similarly, you have, statements talking about how God is not distant from every one of us because he's given his word to us and so forth. So basically, when you hear about God's transcendence, it means he's more and than any created reality and he's distinct from every created reality. Where you hear about God being immanent, it emphasizes his closeness and his intimacy with every created reality.
Okay, Eduardo?
That's beautiful. That's beautiful.
Awesome.
Thanks a lot for the explanation.
No problem.
Gives me more strength.
Well, praise God for that,
yeah.
Eduardo. Thanks. Call anytime. Always happy to talk with you. 888-318-7884 is our number. And we got some lines open. So if you'd like to have – if you have a question for Jimmy Akin, 888-318-7884. Jimmy, I want to – before I go to those lines, however, I want to share a question from Facebook from – I believe it's Denny. Mm-hmm. It could be Durney. If someone is baptized Catholic and got confirmed – and later in life decided to change churches, go to the Pentecostal church, for example. Then he got baptized again. Is that considered a sin against the Holy Spirit?
It is objectively sinful because it implies a depreciation of the work that the Holy Spirit did in your initial baptism.
Uh-huh.
So objectively, yes, it's a slight to the Holy Spirit. However, that doesn't mean that it's going that a person doing that is going to be responsible for it, because they may, you know, be innocently ignorant of the moral character uh-huh. of the act that they're doing, and so they wouldn't be held accountable for it. But objectively speaking, yes, it would involve a depreciation of the value of the work the Holy Spirit did in baptism.
Once one baptism for everyone.
There's one, as St. Paul says, one Lord, one faith, one baptism. And that's historically been understood not just to mean that there is a common baptism among right. Christians, but one is what you get.
Yeah.
That baptism makes a permanent change in the soul, and consequently it is not to be repeated.
Okay. I hope that was helpful. Anna in Ohio, watching on YouTube Live, you are up next. Anna, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, Jimmy. Thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering if you have any information what the Catholic Church's view is on the Holy Fire that occurs mm-hmm. on the Saturday before Orthodox Easter every year.
Mm-hmm. Right. So for people who may not be familiar with this, in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, so the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is the site of Jesus's tomb.
Okay.
And there are some claims that his tomb was elsewhere, but no, it really, we have good evidence that it's the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And it's administered by a group of churches, including the Catholic Church and including Greek Orthodox Church and a few others. And at Orthodox Easter every year, an Orthodox churchman goes into the tomb and emerges with I don't want to say the exact nature of the material because I'll get it wrong, but he emerges with these carrying kind of torches,
okay,
sort of like torches that that catch fire. And this is widely regarded by many in the Orthodox community as a miracle, and so it's called the Holy Fire and so forth. It happens every year. The Catholic Church has no position on this. You will not find any magisterial documents from the Catholic Church that comment on this one way or another in terms of, is it a miracle or is it a natural phenomenon, or if it is a miracle, what its exact significance is. It is my impression from my research into this, and I could be wrong on this, is that even Greek Orthodox officials are somewhat circumspect in what they say about this,
okay,
about whether it's miraculous or not. It's certainly an inspiring thing that helps ignite people's faith.
Okay.
But whether it has a genuinely supernatural origin is something I think that, in at least in modern times, even Orthodox officials tend to be somewhat circumspect about, although I could be mistaken on that.
Okay.
There are natural things that could produce this, including the ignition of things once you come forth from the tomb. I mean, the use of phosphorus,
yeah,
for example. Phosphorus burns on contact with oxygen. It also could be a genuine miracle, because God does miracles for people all over the world, whether they're Catholic or not, whether they're Christian or not. He loves everybody.
Yeah.
And so if this is a genuine miracle that God does in order to inspire people's faith in his son and the resurrection of his son, then that's totally awesome. That's great. But the Catholic Church does not have a position on this one way or the other. So from a Catholic point of view, you could investigate this and conclude it's a miracle. You could also investigate it and conclude that it's not a miracle, but it's just a sign that inspires people's faith.
Does that answer satisfy you, Anna?
It does. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you very, very much. Jimmy, I neglected to ask you all mm-hmm. Day. Let me ask you now. What's okay. up at Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
Oh.
What's going on over there?
Well, it just had a new episode. It always comes out on Friday, and since this is the first Friday of the year, we had a new episode today on the mystery of weight loss, which is how to lose weight and keep it off. Very mysterious for a lot of people. It's already getting a bunch of hits, a bunch of comments. Next week, it's going to be Bob Lazar in Area 51. We're also going to have one on astrology and also what on earth happened at the Dyatlov Pass incident in Russia.
Is that the one where it blew up?
Nope.
Or is that a different
one? Nope, that's a different one.
Oh, Dyatlov Pass.
Yeah, you're thinking right. Tunguska.
Yeah, I was thinking.
Yeah, Dyatlov Pass is even more mysterious.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I will have to look into that. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. You can also find out all about Jimmy, what he's up to, what he's thinking at jimmyakin.com. Thanks for joining us as we conclude the first work week of the year here at Catholic Answers. Thank you, Nick, on sound. Thank you, Brandon. Thank you, Marie. You were on fire today, Marie, call screener. Nice work. Jesus Christ is the light of the nations. And we'll see you next time on Catholic Answers Live.